zodiac, a symbol that now stands for terror,
has killed five and says he's going to kill again.
Psychopath.
Remember, investigators say there were unusually high levels of chloroform found in Casey Anthony's trunk.
But again, OJ appears to be holding a gun to his head.
Police won't confirm a newspaper report that Dahmer has confessed to murder and cannibalism.
It's Murder Monday on the Joe and Alex Show. Listener discretion is advised.
Make sure you use Twitter and Instagram and use the hashtag Murder Monday as Alex takes us through the murder of who?
Well, it's not the murder of who, but the person that orchestrated the murder, which is Jennifer Pan.
Okay.
If you're someone that grew up with parents who valued academics above all else, and you felt the immense crippling pressure of trying to get straight A's no matter what, then you may be able to empathize with the main subject of today's Murder Monday story, Jennifer Pan. Jennifer was born in 1986 to her mom, Bic, and her dad, Han, in Scarborough, Canada. Han was born in Vietnam and came to Canada as a refugee, and shortly after came Bic separately. They got married in Toronto and have Jennifer, and then 3 years later, her little brother, Felix. They work in an auto parts manufacturer and make a very good living. They save their money. By 2004, they're able to buy a big house with a two-car garage. They had a Mercedes and a Lexus. They even had a savings of over $200,000 in the bank.
Dang, that's really good.
Because Jennifer's parents had worked so hard and came from nothing, they expected nothing less from her and her brother Felix. Jennifer starts taking piano lessons at the age of four, and it's obvious that she's very talented from the get-go. A few years later, as Jennifer starts elementary school, she already has a whole case full of awards for her piano playing. But Jennifer's parents wanted more. They enrolled her in figure skating classes, and even as an elementary school student, she wouldn't get home till 10 p.m., and then she'd be required to study until midnight or sometimes after. She'd go to bed and wake up the next day and do it all over again. Even at such a young age, the pressure was so intense that Jennifer began cutting herself with a little razor.
Ugh.
As Jennifer was about to graduate from eighth grade, her fellow students described her as a social butterfly, someone who had a high-pitched laugh. She got along with everybody. She played the flute, swam, practiced martial arts after school, still played piano. But as one of her fellow classmates later put it, Jennifer's whole friendly persona was a facade. Deep inside, Jennifer was tormented with feelings of inadequacy, self-doubt, and shame. And when she failed to win first place at skating competitions, she tried to hide her devastation from her parents, not wanting to add to their disappointment. Her mother, Bic, noticed something was wrong and would comfort her sometimes at night when Han was sleeping and say, "You know, all we want from you is just your best. Just do what you can." Jennifer had been a top student in elementary school, but midway through ninth grade, she had a C average in all subjects with the exception of music. Using old report cards, scissors, glue, and a photocopier, she created a new forged report card with straight A's.
Holy crap, that is a lot of work, a lot of effort to do that.
Every report card. Since universities didn't consider marks from grade 9 and grade 10 for admission, she told herself it wasn't a big deal. Jennifer's parents took her to and from school every day. They monitored every single extracurricular activity she had. And even as a teenager, she wasn't allowed to go to prom, any school dances, or do anything. She wasn't allowed to have a boyfriend. And once in a blue moon, when her parents did allow her to have a sleepover at a friend's house, they purposefully waited as late as possible to drop her off and picked her up by dawn to limit her time away as much as possible. Jennifer's parents probably thought their parenting was because they loved Jennifer and wanted what was best for her. But to Jennifer and her friends, it was tyranny. In 11th grade, Jennifer met a boy named Daniel Wong. He had a huge smile, a big laugh, and had a little bit of a dad bod going on, which I can appreciate. He played trumpet in the school band and in a marching band outside of school. And their relationship was platonic until a band trip to Europe in 03. After a performance in a concert hall filled with smokers, Jennifer actually suffered an asthma attack. She started panicking, was led outside to the tour bus, and almost blacked out. Daniel calmed her down and coached her breathing. After that, Jennifer said, "He pretty much saved my life. It meant everything." And that summer, they started dating. While all of this was going on, Jennifer's grades stayed about average, and she kept doctoring her report cards. She failed calculus and wasn't able to even graduate from high school. Desperate to keep her parents from looking into her grades, she lied and told them that she had been accepted into a local college. She said that her plan was to do 2 years of science, then transfer over to the pharmacology program, which was what her father had always wanted. He was delighted, so he bought her a laptop. She started telling her parents that she was leaving for class every morning, but actually, she'd sit in a library studying used school books she had bought on pharmacology and watching videos on pharmacology.
It's amazing like how she's like living this lie after lie. Like,
yes.
How do you keep it going?
So she didn't even get into college, but she pretty much went anyways because she was taking notebooks filled with notes home every single day to prove to her parents that she was going to class. So she was still learning on the subject. She just wasn't paying to actually get the degree. She also told her parents that she started working as a volunteer at a local children's hospital. Her parents noticed, though, that she didn't have a hospital ID or scrubs to wear. They started getting suspicious and one day decided to hang around to see if she was actually working at the hospital.
All right, we'll find out next as we continue Murder Monday on the Joe and Alex Show.
Jennifer Pan's parents started to doubt that their daughter's story was true, that she was volunteering at a local children's hospital. She had even told them that she was spending the night at a friend's who lived close by nights before she had to work so that her commute was shorter. Secretly, she was spending the night with Daniel. But this day, after her parents insisted on dropping her off themselves, Bick followed Jennifer into the hospital. Jennifer realized her mom had followed her, and so she hid in the ER for hours before coming home. Her parents found out everything after calling her friend to see if she'd actually spent the night there because her friend couldn't lie for her, and her dad wanted to kick Jennifer out of the house when he found out. Jennifer's mom convinced him to let her stay, though, as long as she promised to finish high school and not go anywhere except her piano teaching job. She was forbidden to contact her boyfriend Daniel, who she had been dating in secret for 7 years, but she sneakily found ways to talk to him in the middle of the night even though she couldn't see him.
Damn, Daniel, that's impressive.
Daniel got tired, though, of trying to pursue a relationship with Jennifer and started to see another girl who he ends up falling in love with. Jennifer was desperate and decided to take drastic measures to win Daniel back. Jennifer told Daniel that a man had entered her parents' house in the middle of the night and showed her a police badge. Then several men rushed in and gang-raped her. She told Daniel that after the assault, a bullet was mailed to her in an envelope and it was sent from his new girlfriend as a threat. In the spring of 2010, Jennifer reconnected with a boy named Andrew she had gone to high school with. In school, this boy used to brag about robbing people at knife point, and so when Jennifer told him about her parents, he told her that at one point he had thought about killing his own dad. The story stuck with Jennifer, and she started to imagine how much better her life would be if her own father wasn't around. So Andrew introduced Jennifer to his roommate, a goth kid who wore black nail polish named Ricardo. They hatched a plan for Ricardo to murder her father in a parking lot at his work. Jennifer says she gave Ricardo $1,500, but then the time came to kill her dad, and he flaked and claimed that she only ever gave him $200. So he stopped answering her calls, and Jennifer realized that she and Daniel needed to come up with a lot more of an evil plan than her first one. And so they were going to hire a hit on both of her parents, and she was going to collect their estate totaling $500,000, and they were going to finally be together. So Daniel found three guys willing to do it. And after watching Gossip Girl and John and Kate Plus 8 one evening,
XOXO Gossip Girl,
Jennifer switched an upstairs light on and off as a signal to come in. Three men with guns barged into Jennifer's house. One pointing his gun at Bick while another ran upstairs, shoved a gun at Han's face, and directed him out of bed down the stairs and into the living room. Upstairs, one of the intruders confronted Jennifer outside her bedroom door. According to Jennifer, he tied her arms behind her using a shoelace. He directed her back inside where she handed over approximately $2,500 in cash and then to her parents' bedroom where he located $1,100 in her mother's nightstand and then finally to the kitchen to search for her mother's wallet. In Cantonese, Bick asked Han, how could they enter the house? Jennifer's dad said, I don't know. I was sleeping. One of the intruders yelled, shut up! You talk too much. Where's the blanking money? Han had just $60 in his wallet and told them that. The man screamed, liar! And pistol whipped him in the back of the head.
Ugh.
Bick began weeping, pleading with the men not to hurt their daughter. And that's when one of the intruders replied, rest assured, she is nice and will not be hurt. You can see photos, by the way, of what Jennifer and her parents look like, what the house looks like on Instagram right now at Joe and Alex Show. When we come back, we'll find out how the night ends with Jennifer and her parents. We left off with the intruders breaking in and her mom weeping, pleading with the men not to hurt her daughter. So one of the men led Jennifer back upstairs and tied her arms to the banister, while the two others took Bick and Han to the basement and covered their heads with blankets. They shot Han twice, once in the shoulder and then in the face. He crumpled to the floor. Then they shot Bick three times in the head, killing her instantly, and then fled through the front door. Jennifer somehow managed to reach her phone tucked into the waistband of her pants and dial 911, despite, as she later claimed, having her hands tied behind her back. She said, "Help me, please. I need help. I don't know where my parents are. Please." Hurry. At the 34-second mark of this call, the unexpected happens. Han can be heard moaning in the background. He had awoken covered in blood with his dead wife's body next to him and crawled up the stairs to the main floor. Jennifer yelled down that she was calling 911. Han stumbled outside screaming wildly and saw a startled neighbor who was about to leave for work in the driveway next door. The neighbor called 911. Police and an ambulance arrived at the scene minutes later and Han was rushed to a nearby hospital and then airlifted to another one. York Regional Police interviewed Jennifer just before 3 a.m. She told them that the men had entered the house looking for money, tied her to the banister, and taken her parents to the basement and shot them. 2 days later, the police brought her in again to give a second statement. At the request, she showed how she contorted her body to get her phone, a flip phone, out of her waistband to call police while she was supposedly tied to a banister. Holes began to emerge in Jennifer's story. For instance, the keys to Han's Lexus were in plain view by the front door. If it were indeed a home invasion, why did the intruders not take the car? And why didn't they have a crowbar to get in or a backpack to carry the loot or zip ties to restrain the residents? And most important, why would they shoot two witnesses but leave one unharmed? The police assigned a surveillance team to monitor Jennifer's movements. A few days later, Han had woken up from his three-day induced coma. He had a broken bone near his eye, bullet fragments lodged in his face that doctors couldn't remove, and a shattered neck bone. The bullet had grazed the carotid artery. Remarkably, he remembered everything, including two troubling details. He recalled seeing his daughter chatting softly like a friend, he said, with one of the intruders, and that her arms were not tied behind her back while she was being led around the house. Then the police brought Jennifer in for a third interview. This one developed a different tone. The detective said that he knew that she was involved in the crime. He knew that she had lied to him and said it was in her best interest to fess up. Jennifer, hunched over and sobbing, asked repeatedly, "But what happens to me?" The trial began on March 19, 2014 in Newmarket. It was expected to last 6 months, but stretched for nearly 10. Jennifer was on the stand for 7 days trying to convince the jury that the whole thing was a suicide attempt gone wrong, that she did order a hit on her father, but changed her mind and later didn't want to go through with it. Before the jury delivered the verdict, Jennifer appeared almost upbeat, playfully picking lint off of her lawyer's robes.
Let me get that for you.
When the guilty verdict was delivered, she showed no emotion, but once the press had left the courtroom, she wept, shaking uncontrollably. For the charge of first-degree murder, Jennifer received an automatic life sentence with no chance of parole for 25 years. For the attempted murder of her father, she received another sentence of life to be served concurrently. Daniel and the other men received the same sentence. Jennifer's lawyer told the court that she was open to talking to her family if they wanted to talk to her. But I don't think that's going to happen based on the victim impact statements from Han and her brother Felix, who, by the way, was away out of town at the time of the intrusion.
Could you imagine getting that call?
So this just, like, breaks me. So this is what her dad said in court. "When I lost my wife, I lost my daughter at the same time. I don't feel like I have a family anymore. Some say I should feel lucky to be alive, but I feel like I am dead too. He's now unable to work due to his injuries. He suffers anxiety attacks, insomnia, and when he can sleep, nightmares. He is in constant pain and has given up gardening, working on his cars, and listening to music, since none of those activities bring him joy anymore. He can't bear to be in his house, so he lives with relatives nearby. Felix, Jennifer's brother, moved to the East Coast to find work with a private technology company and to escape the stigma of being a member of the Pan family. He suffers from depression and has become closed off. Han is desperate to sell their family home, but no one will buy it. And at the end of his statement, he addressed Jennifer and said, 'I hope my daughter Jennifer thinks about what has happened to her family and can become a good, honest person someday.'"
Wow.
That is the story of Jennifer Pan.
Let us know what you think. Go on our Twitter. Use the hashtag Murder Monday. It's Joe and Alex Show. Let us know what you think about that. Also, you have those photos up on Instagram, right?
Photos are up of Jennifer, her parents, Bic and Han, and the house that she grew up in, at Joe and Alex Show on Instagram.
Awesome job. Thank you so much, Alex.